I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of September. We usually have an All Things Political Day on Monday, but it was Labor Day yesterday, so we weren't here. So we thought we would have All Things Political today, because who wants to miss All Things Political? And there's a whole lot to talk about. The Guardian asked all 22 presidential candidates, should the U.S. open its borders to more refugees who have fled war-torn Syria? And just one, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, said that the U.S. should take in more, calling on government to accept 65,000 over the next year. Some of the candidates didn't answer, but most said, no, we can't do that. We already do enough. We give a lot of money. The New York Times reported that Russia has sent a military advance team to Syria, signaling that Vladimir Putin is going to expand his military support for Assad. They also report that the U.S. will revamp the plan for rebels to combat ISIS and will ask, what might such a plan be? All the news on the presidential campaigns, there are so many of them, and we celebrated Labor Day yesterday. Our guest, Bob Franken, says, instead of calling it Labor Day, let's just call it Plutocrat Day or maybe Oligarch Day. Let's face it, fellow beachgoers, what we're celebrating these days is fantasy. And he goes on to talk about the disappearing middle class and the decline of unions. Bob Franken is our guest this hour for our Tuesday edition of All Things Political. He's been with us several times before. He is a veteran news journalist in Washington. He's worked for CBS and CNN, currently a frequent guest on MSNBC. He has a column, Frankincense blog, which is syndicated by King Features, and he is a graduate of UW-Madison and began his career as news director at WDLB in Marshfield, Wisconsin. Our phone number for you to join the conversation this hour is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Bob.
Good. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for being with us again, sir.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Let's start with what somebody has called a migrant crisis of biblical proportions. The huge, these horrible, horrible stories that have been coming out of Germany and Hungary and all of these people trying to escape horror in Syria. Do we have a responsibility to take in some of these Syrian refugees?
Well, you know, I would imagine that the Statue of Liberty, with its, you know, give me your tired, your poor, is weeping right now because of what you just cited, that the United States of America, a nation built on immigrants, is unwilling to accept some of these people who are living between life and death right now. They're fleeing the war, and they're going from one danger to another. But, of course, the United States is showing its true colors in its receptivity to Donald Trump, and I'm sure we'll be talking about him in a while. You can't have a political conversation.
I know.
Without talking
right.
about him. But there is a real nativism that has really sort of permeated this country, which is ironic when you think about it, because the true natives are the Native Americans who were here before any of the Europeans arrived.
The Lincoln Chafee, the former Rhode Island governor, who's polling very, very low, said, and I wonder what you thought about this when asked by The Guardian if we should take more refugees. He said the U.S. unfortunately bears a great deal of responsibility for the refugee crisis because of our invasion of Iraq and the spread of chaos in the region as a result.
Well, it's kind of hard to argue that. The Middle East, forgetting for the moment, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But forgetting that, the Middle East is in just chaos, and the United States has certainly played a role in that. But as we've discussed before, it really goes back to 1948, when these countries were falsely carved out at the end of World War II. But for the moment, forgetting that, the U.S. and its invasion of Iraq and all the other superpowers getting involved have certainly created this vacuum where the horrible terrorists, ISIS, have been able to fill part of it. And, of course, you have the awful situation in Syria with a murderous dictator at the helm, and you have all the geopolitics at work with the United States and Russia using the various sides as proxies.
Yeah. And what about a plan? Some of the candidates have talked about a need for us to do more to take on ISIS. The New York Times had a reporter over the weekend, I'm sure you saw, Bob, that the U.S. is going to have to revamp the plan for rebels to combat ISIS. I'm wondering, what are we doing to gather rebels to fight ISIS? The plan isn't working very well. Is there one? Should there be one? Can there be one?
Well, you know, there are many facets to that. Is the United States properly training them? If not, why not? Is it the fact that we're dealing with reluctant rebels who just are not up to the standards that the American military is trying to impose on them? Is it the fact that it's really hard to define who the rebels are, since so many of them
right.
are really avowed enemies of the United States? It's a totally chaotic situation,
right.
And perhaps there is no good answer, because an alternative answer would be the dreaded boots on the ground, which the United States has no will to support anymore.
Well, it appears that the Russians are doing that. That Russia sent a military advance team to Syria. They're building some housing. Some say they're signaling that Putin is going to expand his military support for Assad. Why is he giving support for Assad, and how does this complicate an already really bad situation?
Well, of course, Russia has always considered Assad a client. This is nothing new that Russia is supporting Assad. And their rationale, their stated rationale anyway, is that the United States is in fact incurring in the area. It has got a new agreement with Turkey to use the air facilities there for the campaign to bomb ISIS. And of course, the United States would like to topple Assad, who is a Russian client, as I said. So what we have is this kind of this geopolitical kind of chess game that we thought ended with the Cold War, but mm-hmm. obviously did not.
And 4 million refugees. That's phenomenal.
Yes, 4 million refugees who are willing to take the dangers of the smuggler boats that capsize constantly there. And we've all been moved by that picture of the three-year-old who looks like he's napping, but of course he's dead on the beach. And then you have the jingoism and the xenophobia of countries like Hungary, which has shown its true colors, with a leader who says that the reason not to accept the migrants is because it would jeopardize the European status as a Christian continent.
Ugh. Yeah, that deserves just a moment of silence.
Yeah, and then what happened, of course, is that there was such public relations pressure, and that's the only way to describe it, that finally the other nations of Europe, in particular the Germans, who of all things are looking like the heroes.
I know.
Who basically said, look, with our history and with the history of all the refugees that we caused after, you know, during and after World War II, we have a responsibility, said Angela Merkel, to take these people in. And finally there was a break. Hungary has backed down just a tiny bit, but of course this could be all very temporary.
Mm-hmm. Some of the Republican candidates, when asked this question by The Guardian about what responsibility we have, this is kind of indicative of what others have said. Carly Fiorina said the U.S. can't relax its criteria for letting refugees in, and warned against those who might be affiliated with terrorist activity. We're having to be very careful, she says, about who we let enter this country from these war-torn regions to ensure that terrorists are not coming here.
Well, it would be easy to dismiss the kind of rhetoric you're getting from many Republicans as just an effort to exploit what is really anti-Muslim prejudice in the United States. It would be easy to do that, but the simple fact of the matter is that there is little doubt that some terrorists have integrated themselves with the immigrants who are coming in here and present a danger wherever they go, whether it's Europe or whether it's the United States. It's going to rely, however, on top-notch intelligence work to try and ferret them out and prevent that. What we have now is a humanitarian crisis.
Yes.
What we also have is a threat to Western Europe and the United States from those terrorist organizations. And somehow we have to sift through all that and make sure that we take care of ourselves as human beings at the same time protecting ourselves as human beings.
Yeah. And interestingly, Trump had the least vindictive response from most of the Republican candidates. He was asked on MSNBC last week if we should take more refugees. His answer, the answer is possibly yes, he said. So horrible on a humanitarian basis when you see that. It's incredible what's going on.
Well, you know, as long as they don't come through Mexico, I think they'll be okay. Yes.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the leader of Hungary has been likened to Donald Trump because of the anti-immigrant rhetoric that he says. Of course, nobody expects Donald Trump to be consistent. As a matter of fact, he doesn't believe that he does have to be consistent because he says that the art of making a deal means you have to be flexible. So it doesn't matter that he is basically saying we've got to protect south of the border, or in Scott Walker's case, north of the border. We have to be humanitarian as long as they don't come from Mexico.
And yet people seem to be saying your flexibility is fine with me as favorability ratings went up in the last few days. Donald Trump.
I think what has happened is people aren't really paying attention and analyzing what Donald Trump is saying. Right now, he has tapped into, and I know I'm not the first person to say this, he has tapped into a justified anger that people have in the United States with the established way of doing things and with the established people who, in fact, control our lives and our economy. And he has tapped into that. On the other hand, he has also just been quite the entertainer. I mean, I described him on television today, the other day, as Don Rickles, but not as attractive. But he is somebody who is, at the moment, angering people and making them laugh at this establishment that deserves the ridicule that it gets.
He doesn't have much of a sense of humor, though, Bob, does he?
Well, I think he does.
Really?
Yeah, I do. I think that the guy is quick with a one-liner. It's almost, you remember Mort Saul, I'm sure.
Sure.
Who made a career also out of insulting everybody. And at the end of his act, he would say, is there anybody here I haven't offended? And I think that that is sort of the Donald Trump way of doing things.
Let's go to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton for a moment. He's up 10 points. Some would say it's expected. He's from that part of the country. But 10 points over Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire? That's a lot.
Well, I think it's a lot. I think that part of the explanation is that he, too, is tapping into the Democratic disgust in the party with the old way of doing things. I mean, the progressives, and that, of course, is his base. The progressives believe that Wall Street and the financial community is coddled to the point of almost criminality, what should be criminality, on the other hand. But part of it also is the fact that, let me just put this bluntly, Hillary Clinton has not exactly been a terrific candidate. As a matter of fact, one could argue that she's been anything but a terrific candidate. Not only does she have the old Clinton credibility problems, and the old Clinton way of trying to either be the lawyerly or dissembling, however you want to look at it, but also, and this is the kind of thing that only somebody in broadcasting might look at, she can't read a teleprompter. If she in fact has her every answer, poll-driven answer, scripted for her, she's a lousy reader of the script. She doesn't come across as genuine. It's that old saying by George Burns, if the key to success in show business is sincerity, and if you can fake that, you've got
it
made.
Right.
She's not very good at that. She just doesn't do a good live shot, to put it in TV terms.
So is she no longer the anointed one?
Well, you know, that's interesting. Within the party, she still holds a lot of favor within the established Democratic Party. And you use the word anointed. I think a lot of people believe that she comes across as entitled. Her staff, her massive staff, makes the point that, no, we expected this to be more of a slugfest than everybody thought it would be. But I think that she still has to be considered the favorite, which brings us then to Joe Biden. And I'm sorry if I'm tromping on your question.
That's fine.
But Joe Biden, of course, is who suffered the terrible loss of his son earlier this year and keeps delaying the deadline for when he's going to make an announcement that he's obviously flirting with being a candidate. There are some people who say that the worst thing he could do is announce and get into a fight with Hillary Clinton for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party until he knows whether the Hillary Clinton campaign is going to implode. If he can wait long enough, and in fact Hillary does ultimately implode, then he can be the one in the party who rides to the rescue. Otherwise, he's going to have a very divisive fight with her.
Mm-hmm. Well, she can't get away from this email question. It's just endless.
Well, it's endless for a good reason. It's endless because, again, everything is a lawyerly response. Everything is, not everything, but a lot of her answers are disingenuous. She tries everything, including intimidating the reporters who have the audacity to question her mm-hmm. about these things. And then when she realizes that's not going to work, she tries the humility thing, saying, I made a mistake. Okay. So she's now come up with her different spins on things. By the way, my favorite from her is the complaint that she's oh so careful in her answers, the lawyerly answers. She says, well, isn't that better than Donald Trump, who just shoots from the hip, you know, who just says whatever comes to his mind? And I would suggest that somehow between the lawyerly answers and shooting from the hip, there's a huge area. It's called candor.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that she's had all this time, and she's already had this really vigorous campaign 8 years ago against Barack Obama, where she did the same thing and she lost. You'd think with all the money and all the advisors that they'd be able to work something out for her that made her appear more like a human being.
Well, you have to sort of allow yourself to appear like a human being.
Sure.
You have to sort of let go of this tightly wound intellectual approach to things and be a human being. Her husband was very good with it. I mean,
yes.
All used to laugh about how he could get away with saying constantly, I feel your pain,
mm-hmm.
and all this type of thing. And I really believe that there is a wide body of feeling that she doesn't feel the pain.
Scott Walker appears to be disappearing.
One would think maybe he's behind that wall in Canada.
Maybe. Well, it hasn't quite been built yet. He seems to be, nobody else sort of endorsed that. That kind of fizzled, didn't it?
Well, it did. And speaking of fizzling, I think that his campaign has. First of all, he got trumped. Everybody got trumped.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, there is a feeling, fair or unfair, that he's really not up to the task intellectually, that he's a tremendous politician, at least on the state level, but now he's playing in the big leagues, and perhaps he's not ready for the big leagues.
Bob Franken is our guest, and you're listening to a Tuesday edition of All Things Political. We could just call it something else, I guess, because it's normally on Monday. So we're just talking to Bob Franken today about politics. He's a veteran journalist. He's worked for CBS, CNN. He's on MSNBC now. He has a weekly column. And we have looked at, and I'm interested in what you, we're going to do a show on this refugee crisis tomorrow, Scotty. Tomorrow at 1, we're going to talk about this at length. But I'm interested in your thoughts, too, about whether or not the United States should be doing more here. Should we take 65,000 refugees, as Martin O'Malley has said? Should we take 25,000? Should we at least take more than 1,500 that we have taken now? It breaks your heart to see what's happening here. How should the United States, as a member of this world, deal with this? We're also looking, of course, at all things political. Is Hillary Clinton, does she need to switch gears here and let us see more who she is? Is she too defensive? Is she too scripted? Does she need to interact with the people more? Is her campaign kind of floundering here? How do you explain Bernie Sanders 10 points ahead? And what about Joe Biden? Would he enter the race and take her on? He's already had a couple other runs for the presidency in which he didn't win. So how does that factor in? And we have to talk about Labor Day, which was yesterday. Bob has written a really good column about not calling it Labor Day, perhaps calling it Plutocrat Day, or maybe Oligarch Day. Here's our phone number. We'd love to hear from you at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at @KDunnShow. So we'll be with you momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bob Franken is here now. We have a ton of phone calls. Let's go to them, starting with Gary in Rhinelander. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. I really enjoy your show. This first-time caller, or first-time being able to talk.
Thanks, Gary.
My question is, or comment, is about the humanitarian thing with the refugees, is that, yes, to me the word is if we do help. I believe it should be a two-part thing, and I believe, yes, we should help. But the one part should be that we could put all these refugees in a camp with the help of all the countries that's willing to give support already. And number two, we take care of the problem of why they are leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds simple, but yeah, it's not.
No, it sure isn't. Bob, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, what do you think? What do you think?
Yeah, I was waiting for your pearls of wisdom.
No, I'm waiting for yours.
Oh, well,
that's why
we have you on. I'm the swine before the pearl. First of all, I mean, I couldn't help but think, you know, every caller prefaces the call with, I really enjoy your program. I would like just once for somebody to say, I really hate your program.
No, don't do that or you'll get somebody, but that'll be okay too.
But hopefully it'll be on a day when I'm not. The idea of camps, first of all, the practical idea of camps is that they become squalid, they become permanent. I mean, there are camps around the world for refugees that have been there for a decade or
mm-hmm.
longer.
Mm-hmm.
So that would not be the answer, because these are human beings, and to be perfectly honest about it, they have every right to be integrated into the human community. That's number one. Number two, the objection to them is the nature of sending people to camps has a little bit of the flavor of prison camps, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's such a sordid history when it comes to camps that would be something that could be avoided. Now, as for the cause, first of all, I would suggest that there are causes. And the complexity and the difficulties of dealing with those causes, such as the Syrian government, and such as ISIS or ISIL or whatever you want to call them, are just hugely complex and have proven impossible to do. We've already talked about the geopolitical aspects of this, and how entrenched the Syrian government is, and that kind of thing. So, the question then becomes, what do we do about it? And there are no good answers.
No. And even John Kerry, when asked about this, said that our efforts will remain focused on helping existing refugee camps in other nations, Jordan, Lebanon, in Turkey. So maybe he said that we have to set up some sort of refugee camp structure for the time being in order to deal with it. As you said, they've already been in place for a long time, and it's horrible conditions. And
well, it's horrible conditions, and it's also breeding grounds for terrorism.
Yes, right. Gary, thanks very much for the call. Woody in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi.
We're having a Rhinelander
festival today.
Yep.
You know,
we are.
I lived in Germany for 4.5 years. I was a soldier there during the 1990s. And after World War II was over, Germany had somewhat of a demographic crisis with all the men who were killed in battle. And during the rebuilding process, after the war was over, Germany allowed hundreds of thousands of people in from Turkey to refill their labor pool to help rebuild some cities like Frankfurt and Mannheim that were bombed by the Allies and stuff like that after the war was over. And the average German, just looking at it, I got to know, you know, more than a few German people I was living over there, probably doesn't like the influx of tens of thousands of more Muslims into their country any more than, let's say, the average American would like, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not, you know, I'm not sure how many, you know, illegal immigrants we have in the country, but the average German probably feels like the average American on this issue, and that's why a man like Donald Trump has, you know, resonated with the average American. I think the average German doesn't have a lot of say in all these migrants coming in. I mean, they probably feel like their wages are going to be depressed and a lot of other things. So So anyway, I just wanted to express that because I lived there for a number of years. And it's not that Germans hate foreigners. It's just that I think that, you know, that they feel like their country is, for lack of a better way of putting it, being overrun. Well, anyway, thank you for listening. And
yeah.
I'll listen to Mr. Franken's answer over there.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Bob.
Well, first of all, Germany has a special responsibility because of what, because of the horrific things that were done by the country, you know, that caused World War II and all that type
right.
of thing. And certainly the leadership there recognize that, as do many of the German citizens. However, in any country with such a large population, whether it's Germany or the United States, you have the skinhead group. They call the soccer hooligan group, that type of thing, whether it's Germany or anything else. A difference between Germany and the rest of the continent and the United States is that there's an ocean. So the refugees, and I prefer to call them that, can make it as far as Germany once they can get off the smuggler ships or make the very dangerous overland efforts at escaping. But Germany has, for a variety of reasons, a special responsibility, in addition to which you now have a Eurozone, which claims to be sort of a quasi-government of the entire continent. And so when Germany assumes the leadership role of the Eurozone, which seems to be what has happened, then it really is sort of speaking to the other countries. For instance, France has relented and is going to be letting in refugees and all of that type of thing. But I think the caller is absolutely right that there's going to be a resentment on the part of the average German who worries that his job is going to be taken away by some migrant.
Yeah. And don't you think that, I mean, with this word Christian keeps popping up from the Hungarian head of state, and there are a lot of people who are concerned about Muslims, right? Let's face it.
Well, I mean, that doesn't seem to be limited to Germany. It doesn't
right.
seem to be limited to the
Not
Europe.
At all.
Certainly, there's a religious war of sorts going on in the United States, whether it's manifested by what's going on in Kentucky, whether it manifests itself racially, because there is, of course, another, an ancillary war going on between people who feel that whites are being displaced as the people who rule in the United States. You have all of these kinds mm-hmm. of groups who are trying to maintain their supremacy, and the simple truth is that the world's population is growing more diverse, and that is very scary to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Kentucky for a moment here. What is the purpose of Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee meeting with Davis in jail, the clerk of the Rowan County, Kentucky? Who are they trying to rally here? It is, and where does this issue go?
Well, the issue goes to their trying to be the one who maintains their base. By the way, the judge has just ordered her released.
Oh, really? I didn't hear
yes,
that.
Yes, yes.
Oh.
I mean, this just happened just before airtime.
Oh.
So they may not even get their chance to go in and posture with their meeting. But they're competing for this fundamentalist Christian base that is a significant portion of the Republican Party base, and they're fighting it out all too politely. But of course, they have their martyr, or they thought they had their martyr, in the clerk from Kentucky, and they make the claim, of course, that this is all part of a war on religion,
right.
which is a little bit ludicrous when you think about it. Let's really antagonize a lot of viewers right now by pointing out that what the Constitution declares is not just freedom of religion, but more importantly, freedom from religion. The people who settled in this country were fleeing the religious persecution that they got in Europe. So now you have candidates like Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee saying that those liberals and the Supreme Court, which of course is not all that liberal, is turning on Christianity and making martyrs out of Christians when that's probably through the looking glass.
Mm-hmm. Are they trying to say that if you're a clerk and you have these religious beliefs that you don't have to sign the marriage decree? Or I don't know what the point is here, Fuller.
Well, she's saying that her office, which requires her signature on marriage licenses, it is a violation of her individual conscience, her practice of religion, for her to, in effect, allow same-sex marriages in that county. And the fallacy in all that is that's fine. And then if you can't do that, then resign the position,
right,
because you do not have the right in a constitutional democracy in the United States to impose your religious views to deny the rights of other people.
Right. Let's go to Gregory next in Hudson. Hello, Gregory.
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Gregory.
Just a quick note. I saw a news story yesterday, I think it was. German families are actually taking these Syrian refugees in into their own homes. And, you bring up the idea that if you put these people all together, like in camps or whatever, I don't know if there's resentment or if there's anger. Maybe that's, I don't think it'll breed terrorism, but how about spread them out with families that have places to put them in their homes and make them, just temporarily. I would imagine these Syrians want to go back home someday,
Sure.
I don't think it's going to be a permanent situation. If Syria could be a place to live for these people someday in the future, I'm pretty sure they'd want to go back home,
Mm-hmm.
But that's all.
All right, Gregory. And there have been people who have offered that. I'm sure you saw that story about Iceland, that they were going to take a couple thousand and all of a sudden, 10,000 people signed up in Iceland to have Syrian families come stay with them. There's been some goodness around, hasn't there?
Well, there has been. Of course, that's consistent with what Pope Francis has suggested, that parishes throughout should welcome and give sanctuary to some of these refugees and all of that. But, yes, there is. Just when you're getting really cynical about humanity, then you see sites like the arrival of the migrants in Munich, met by applause,
yes,
and people handing out food. It reminds one of the immigrant experience when people were first coming to the United States. My parents were among them. They've described to me what it was like the first time they'd seen the Statue of Liberty, which meant that they were finally safe and all of that, after crossing an Atlantic worrying about submarines and that kind of thing. And I think that this is kind of an analogous situation.
We seem to forget that. A lot of Americans forget that. We all came from people who took treacherous, not everybody, but, when you look at our ancestors, so many of them were fleeing, persecution and death and poverty, and we forget who we are sometimes.
Well, and I think that makes the hate-filled campaigns of some of the politicians, whether they're presidential politicians or whether they're sheriffs in Arizona, which many people would feel that's particularly contemptible, given the history of the United States of America.
Right, yeah. Gregory, thank you for your call. Lynn in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, Kathleen and Bob. My comment is actually it's both the immigrant and labor. My great-grandfather, Clement Płotek, was a Polish immigrant who was murdered at the Latimer Massacre for union organizing, he and his brother-in-law. Yesterday, I was manning a 15-now table at our local Labor Day celebration, and I had people reluctant to sign. They would tell me their stories. They're barely making it. This child care is outrageous. They can't afford to put food on the table on a consistent basis. But we have a homegrown oligarch here who has an anecdotal, I'm trying to be very careful, history of being a bully. And even explaining the law that they were protected, they wouldn't sign asking for a living wage. It's reprehensible that you have to be so fearful that one person holds so much power over the lives of so many families.
Well, and that was sort of the point about the column that Kathleen alluded to. The truth is that the union, the labor movement, seems to have lost. There is, of course, quite a history about the organizing of the labor union. For instance, the terrible the violent wars that were conducted so mine workers in West Virginia and Kentucky could unionize. The other day I read that there is now just one union mine in Kentucky.
Really?
Yes, everything else is now non-union. Starting certainly with the Reagan administration and the victory that he had over the unionized air traffic controllers, the management side has consistently been able to downgrade the influence of unions. Union busting has become something that is an acceptable part of operating a corporation. And then you have the politicians like Scott Walker, who are basing an entire campaign on the fact that he was able to go in and blow up the public employees' unions.
Mm-hmm.
Add to that the fact that the unions themselves were flabby and dogmatic, oftentimes refusing to deal with the present as opposed to living in the past and all of that. And now you have a situation where you've seen the disappearance of the middle class, which was to a great degree built by the fact that there were labor unions, and you have the problem with the economic inequality that we have in this country.
And you remind us, and we need to be reminded of what it is, the poorest half of the population, you wrote yesterday, owns 2.5% of the wealth. The top 1% owns 35%.
You cannot have a consistent democracy with that kind of thing. When people start wondering about whether playing for the team is worth it, if they feel like they're being had, then sooner or later you're going to lose the support of the people. And this country is in danger of not existing if that occurs.
So could the country elect somebody who's speaking to that very issue more than anybody else, and that's Bernie Sanders?
Well, Bernie Sanders is sort of like George McGovern as a candidate, I believe, and I suspect that I'm going to be vilified by my friends on the left about this, but he is somebody who proudly proclaims that he is a Democrat, ready for the S word, socialist.
Mm-hmm.
This is a country that fears socialism. It fears it, and those on the other side, particularly on the right, and those who are in the corporate positions, are going to find it very easy to vilify him if he becomes the candidate. They would probably fear a Joe Biden or somebody who's more moderate, that kind of thing, who is willing to deal with the business community. But already you hear at the slightest call for economic justice, for instance, raising the minimum wage, as I said in the column, above slave wage, you get all these people who are saying we're going to shut down, we're going to cut staff, we're going to move to another country, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, there's going to be an economic war one way or the other in this country. I don't think that a Bernie Sanders ultimately would prevail in this election because the people with money would use quite a bit of it to make sure that the people were convinced to vote against their interests and repudiate a Bernie Sanders.
Mm. Lynn, thanks for your call. Chuck from Green Bay sends this email, Bob. What about Martin O'Malley for president? He sounds normal.
Well, that is not necessarily an advantage in the world of politics.
Maybe not.
But he has not made much of an impact. I think his strategy was similar to the one I described about a potential one for Joe Biden, sort of waiting for Hillary Clinton to implode and then being the person who rides to the rescue. He has not made much of an impact. Usually people say, Martin, oh, who? That kind
right.
of thing. And there are some people who worry about how long he'd be able to sustain a campaign.
Hmm. More phone calls for Bob Franken in just a moment. Bob Franken is our guest from time to time for an All Things Political program, which we're celebrating today instead of Labor Day, which we celebrated yesterday. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and our email is talk@wpr.org. If you want to send messages on our Facebook page, oh, and I must tell you, remember last week we talked about elephants a little bit when we were looking at the Scientific American myths that we have, and elephants do have incredible memories. and they're really smart. So our guest said, I had a picture in my living room of an elephant who did a painting for me, and several of you asked, well, where is the painting? He he doesn't have a memory like an elephant because he forgot to send it, but he remembered the next day. So the painting by the elephant is now on our Facebook page for those of you who remember that show and have been waiting for days to see the picture. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. More calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655. Congress is back today, Bob, and I just wanted to ask you about this nuclear deal with Iran. The Democrats do have enough votes now to sustain a veto from the president. Is that right?
They have apparently 41 votes now. That would mean that if they all voted according to the dictates of Harry Reid, the minority leader, they would vote to maintain a filibuster, which would kill the legislation. That would spare the president the embarrassment of having to veto this this legislation, because the House is going to go along. But it was not clear whether the 41, or 40, which is all that's needed, would actually, in fact, vote to maintain the filibuster. So it's not clear.
I see.
But this thing could just sort of fizzle away if, in fact, the Senate never even debated it.
Mm-hmm. And what else is on the agenda? Is there a looming shutdown here? What's that all about? September 30th?
There's always a looming shutdown.
Yeah, it seems to be the case, right?
There is, and right now the big bugaboo this year is not health care, but Planned Parenthood.
Right.
Where, of course, some people were able to come in and infiltrate and put together an edited video that seemed to show shabby practices when it came to selling fetal parts to doctors for research, that kind of thing. It's all very questionable, but it has been something that has rallied the anti-abortion Republican base.
Sure has.
And the Ted Cruzes of this world are now saying that unless you defund Planned Parenthood, then as far as he's concerned, you should shut down the government. And, of course, in Ted Cruz's world, the government should always be shut down. As a matter of fact, you have to wonder if he would be elected president, whether his first act would be just to shut down the entire government and have him not president of anything.
Well, there's a thought. Rick is next in Madison. Hey, Rick.
Hi, how are you, Kathleen?
Fine,
Bob,
how are you?
This is for you. Okay. Kathleen, I hate your show.
Really, Rick?
No, I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Well, all right. Well, I take umbrage at that.
What I'm calling about is I'm wondering if we could do, this is going to be about the refugee crisis.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
If we follow the money, we bill Syria, these other people where they're running from, for the housing and maintenance of all these people. Could we follow that money trail? It would be like sanctions, but it would be each individual country following the money trail to get reimbursed for doing this. And then some of that money would also be used to repatriate these people back to their country when that time came. Does that make sense?
Well, I think you make a couple of very good points. Number one, the United States is going to be sending money, even though there is resistance in this country to accepting many of the refugees. There is no resistance to sending money to be used for humanitarian purposes. But another ancillary issue is the fact of a lack of involvement by the other Arab countries in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, all of them are refusing really to take any of these refugees in. And it would seem that this might be a good way to put pressure on these countries to help with this situation, number one. And number two, would put those who are waiting there in a better position to return to Syria if, in fact, that's what they wanted to do.
And why is that? Are they making a statement to ISIS? Are they paying off these people in some way?
You're asking me to explain the mindset of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And better people than I have failed miserably at that.
Rick, thank you very much for the call. Rich in Woodstock. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. It's been a long time since I've been able to call in with you, Kathleen, and I'm glad I'm able to do it. I just wanted to take issue with some of the things your guest has said. One of the things, I'm a high school teacher, have been for 33 years in Illinois, and while your guest has cast aspersions on the governor of Wisconsin for taking on the teachers' union, I think if you want to see what happens if something isn't done about the control of public employees by the unions, you'd have to compare Illinois to Wisconsin. And honestly, all my adult life, as I had thought through things, every time I was involved in a job that included a union control, the unions had control, the employees didn't have control. And what's happening in Illinois is a classic example of when they're giving overwhelming control. The pension system in the state of Illinois is broken, severely broken, but the people that are getting pensions, of which I'm part of and I benefit from, are getting pensions that are ridiculous. I mean, are ridiculously good. I'll be making six figures in a few years as a retired teacher, and I am guaranteed a pension, a 3% increase on my pension, and it'll take me, I think, 17 years of retirement to make more than I did in my entire working time as a teacher. And that's all due to the fact that the teachers' union and the unions of public employees have massive control, because in Wisconsin, in the first election of Scott Walker, the teachers' union in Wisconsin contributed over $150 per person. If you looked at the amount of money that the teachers' union spent to defeat Scott Walker the first time and divided by the amount of teachers that were supporting that union, it worked out to over $150 per teacher. That's ridiculous. And honestly, I mean, I understand the need for unions initially, but every union that I know of now has become self-defeating. They're interested in the union and not the employees that put them there.
Thank you, Rich, for your call. Bob?
Well, I know we're running out of time. It's a complicated response. First of all, if he's making all that money, I'm wondering if he'd want me to move in with him. Secondly, the whole issue about pensions, remember now that pensions are negotiated. And in lieu of wages, as a matter of fact, people are promised pensions, and now governments everywhere are trying to renege on those pensions. And, of course, in the private sector, we've gone from pensions to the very, very fragile 401k system where we're at the mercy, and our retirement is at the mercy of the stock market. That's number one. Number two, he makes the point that unions at one time had a role that they had to play, but no longer. The reason it's no longer is because of hard-fought union victories against management. Thirdly, however, in the case of teachers' unions, there is little doubt that they have often been, particularly in large cities, an impediment to progress. And that gets to the complaint against labor unions, which is to say, no, we've always done it this way. We're not going to adjust in any way. And therefore, we become somewhat irrelevant and, more importantly, somebody that is easily taken down by an ambitious politician. But you have, in addition to that, the Republican Party, that part of its article of faith is that it opposes labor unions, part of which is because labor unions usually contribute to the Democrats. So
yes.
Scott Walker comes along, and he, of course, is basically carrying out that article of faith for the GOP.
Thank you so much, Rich. It makes me think we should do a show on the Illinois pension system and others. That would be interesting for us to do. Well, Bob, we have to say goodbye, but we have 30 seconds, so anything coming up that you think we ought to be paying attention to? There's a lot, it seems.
Yeah. Washington is going to be just a little beehive of activity. We've got the Pope coming in.
Oh, the Pope, yeah. What's the Pope going
in
to talk about? He's
going to talk about things that are probably going to antagonize Republicans.
And some members of the Vatican, it sounds like, too.
He's going to be speaking to Congress and all of that. And then we'll have gridlock in this city. Then we'll have the government shutdown or the fear of the government shutdown. And we have the debt ceiling coming up. And that's always a white-knuckle thing, whether the United States of America will default. Oh, yeah, this is going to be fun city for a while.
Go have an ice cream sundae. You'll feel better. Thanks, Bob, as always, for being
with us.
Bob Franken, our guest this hour for a Tuesday edition of All Things Political. Bob has been a journalist for a long time. He's worked for CBS and CNN. He's a frequent guest on MSNBC now, and he writes a weekly column, Frankincense. It's syndicated by King Features in U.S. newspapers. He has Wisconsin ties, graduate of UW-Madison, and started his whole career in Marshfield, Wisconsin. So we thank him so much for being with us. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our downtown, handsome city, Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with another hour and examine the question, why do we work?